Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Munro Dodd. Almost a century ago, in 1916, a renowned race car driver came to Kansas City to compete in a 100-mile race. The dirt track was poor and quickly torn up by those cars, and on the 32nd lap, this famous driver's car bounced off the surface once too often, broke a water connection, and that was the end for that race of a driver named Eddie Rickenbacker. At the time, he was a famous name in motorsports. In a newspaper ad of the era, Goodyear didn't even have to use his first name in saying that Rickenbacker drove on Goodyear tires. 2 years later, in 1918, Eddie Rickenbacker became even more famous as a flying ace, knocking down enemy planes. When he came back to Kansas City, it was to speak about his dazzling skill in World War I. Although the name of Eddie Rickenbacker has faded a bit from our common memory, he represented an age when America developed a fascination with speed, and especially with individuals who had the gumption to master it. Our guest today has looked at that era and the life of Eddie Rickenbacker. He's John F. Ross, author of Enduring Courage, Ace Pilot Eddie Rickenbacker and the Dawn of the Age of Speed, out this month from St. Martin's Press. John has served as executive editor of American Heritage, and he's on the board of editors at Smithsonian Magazine. John Ross, good morning and welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning, Munro, and thanks for having me on.
John joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. John, if we may, let's begin by if you'll summarize the achievements of this fascinating man.
It's hard to know where to begin. This guy, Eddie Rickenbacker, was known. His face was known to more people around the turn of the early 20th century than the president's. He was America's big hero. He was, as you mentioned, a big race car driver, and they drove in the early Indianapolis 500s, had quite a winning record, then went on to become the ace of aces in World War I, which was the, you know, he shot down more Germans than any other American by a pretty significant factor. Went on to found Eastern Airlines, all sorts of things.
I believe you mentioned also that he owned the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for a while.
He did indeed. Not only did he drive early on, but in it in the first days when they just put the bricks in, the brickyard and all that. But during a very tricky time over the Depression, he owned the track and really kept it going when it wasn't something that really was a sure thing.
It seems that Eddie Rickenbacker was born at just the right time, when the internal combustion engine was getting light enough to go fast and to power race cars and airplanes. Can you talk a little bit about that great change in the world and how Eddie Rickenbacker melded into that?
You know, you got a lot of things going on around that time. Industrial innovations are changing everything. You got the elevator and skyscrapers beginning to happen and all sorts of things that we take, of course, for granted, but I really think that it was the internal combustion engine, right, basically the gasoline engine, that became light enough and efficient enough to power the first really practical car in 1895 when Eddie was 5 years old. And then, of course, the airplane with the Orville and Wilbur Wright in 1903, just 8 years later. So you have a situation when Eddie is, he's 5 years old and, the first car is really, I think the first race they went about 7 miles an hour. You find that there he is at that age. And then you flip forward about 10 years later and he's racing at 80 miles an hour. The first airplane, he's 12 and nobody's flown. And another 10 years after that, he's in the skies over northeastern France in these incredible dogfights with all the students of the Red Baron. And so what you see is this incredible time in American history when speed breaks onto the American scene. And we've never looked back. I mean, you get these incredible writing. People write about, when you're driving in a car and the scenery blurs, kind of because you're going fast. Well, people were going, well, what is this? And we love it. And give us more. And Eddie Rickenbacker was the guy who was in these really dangerous machines, pushing them all over the place, seeing what their limits were and really showing America what speed was about and how exciting it could be.
And I guess at the time, you never knew when your engine was going to blow up.
Oh my god! Oh my gosh! Yeah, when your steering column was going to fall off, when you were going to, these poor guys early on hadn't, it's the technology was so new that these guys in the race cars they didn't put seatbelts on. They hadn't come up with the idea of a rearview mirror. So what they did instead, if you can believe this, they had a mechanician. There was another guy sitting next to the driver, right? It was so loud they couldn't talk. They're sitting right next to each other, so they would have to tap. So the mechanician would look back, and if a car was coming up, it tapped. They'd have these code tapping them on their knees. Right. Well, they weren't sitting. They had no seat belts. There was no windscreen. There were no helmets, hard helmets, until later. So, and the steering wasn't geared. So if you hit a bump and you went off, you'd hit a picket fence and you stopped cold, people routinely went airborne and with, as Eddie did a number of times, broke ribs and contusions. A lot of people died, of course, too. But it's crazy to think back what these guys were doing. And as you mentioned with the Kansas City track, you know, they hadn't even really worked out crowds. You know, the surface of the roads. They didn't have macadam. They were on horse tracks, which were oval, and they just said, hey, let's pour a little hot oil on gravel and dirt, and then we'll put a couple steamrollers over. And but anyway, these cars would go around and around and around. They'd start eating up this surface. And pretty soon, these big, heavy tires would start spitting out, and the drivers called it gumbo, these clods. I mean, some baseball-sized clods of this stuff that would go flying. And they didn't have windshields. And they had goggles, but, you know, no helmets to speak of. And, you know, crazy things happened. It was so dangerous.
Gumbo, a lot of people in Kansas City have houses built on a foundation of gumbo, and we know what it's like. The track, I've got to admit, was I looked this up on the Internet, and it apparently was out near Dodson at the end of a streetcar line, about a mile north of a track that was a board track later built in 1922, for those local folks who wonder which track this dirt track was. John Rush, you call Eddie Rickenbacker an irascible, death-defying hero who helped set the dizzying pace of our modern machine-driven age. He was irascible and therefore not entirely likable, I take it, and death-defying, and that goes way deep into his risk calculations, doesn't it?
Oh, my God, what an int. It's all part of the package. And getting into this guy, you know, I first got to know Eddie Rickenbacker when I was a kid, and I picked up a copy of Fighting the Flying Circus, and it's his memoir of, you know, flying in dogfights in World War One against the Germans, and it's daring do in the skies with these machines that are shrieking, and they're so new, and it's all very exciting. And it stuck with me for years. And as I got older, I kind of got interested. Well, who was this guy who would put himself out in these incredibly dangerous, risky things? And it became out that he, you know, it was this combination of this irascibility, this poor kid from Columbus who was really fighting to make his way in a new place with immigrant parents. You know, I'm not sure at the end of this book if I really would want to, you know, if I got the chance to meet him, whether I'd really like him or not. A great deal of respect for what he did, but he was a fighter. And he did, as you mentioned, Monroe, push these boundaries of really, he was the first right stuff. I mean, Tom Wolfe talked about the space age and all these all those guys. The beginning of the modern era, when all these planes and automobiles started happening, started going faster than anybody could have imagined, faster than anybody, the body had been pushed by horse or anything like that. It really started to change the whole dynamics. And we needed new icons and role models to get in there and figure out, well, what was the difference between being a daredevil and just, you know, going all out and dying because you just didn't care about risk, and yet not being too safe because then you couldn't push these things and you couldn't really take advantage. And so he charted this very thin, fine, incredible course of risk assessment and all that, and really led the nation in letting people understand what this was all about. He was that first generation of right stuff guys.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with author John Ross, who has written a book about Eddie Rickenbacker. John, you say he had the steady nerves of a professional risk taker. Now, another example of a professional risk taker would be what, a gambler or a spy? What kind of risk takers do you envision Eddie Rickenbacker being like?
Interesting way, you know, you got to remember back then around the turn of the century, you know, professional football was just kind of an amateur game. There really wasn't a whole lot of, there was horse racing where big crowds came, and boxing. So people were jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge and things like that, that kind of risk taking. But it wasn't, you know, really wasn't developed, thought out. People, you know, were coming out of a time, of course, when life was pretty risky and one didn't kind of go out of one's way to look for risk. So this is kind of a very kind of modern invention.
Yeah. And so you talk about risk analysis, which today would mean I check the stock market and I plug some figures into some software and I consider what I'm seeing, none of which, of course, was available to Eddie Rickenbacker, who was acting out of his own, I guess, intuition or gumption or what. But how did his risk analysis work? Can you tell?
Absolutely. And you can see him kind of developing it as it went on, because the province of car racing was at first amateur. You know, it was an amateur, and these were often the sons of very wealthy men who could afford cars and the expense of keeping them up and having a couple of them because they were breaking down all the time in racing. And Eddie represented really the first time that he came in as a professional, as a guy who was committed to this as a career, not as an avocation. And along with that, you can see him in the early days with car racing. He is examining the track beforehand. He is looking at his competition. He's kind of trying to game, you know, the risk out there and what he has to do to win. And later on in World War One, when he takes command of the 94 Squadron, and they're up against the last-ditch German effort, and the Germans realize that all is going to be lost, and they put out everything in the air, and these guys are pros. They've been flying a lot longer in war than we have. Eddie has to look at the young guys, and he has to look at the more veteran American flyers, and he has to really bring them together into what is – you know, enough risk, and when do you turn and do you leave? And, you know, that's a very hard thing to communicate and get, especially in a war situation when so much is on the line. So you really begin to seeing him really, really getting down to these, talking with him about various different scenarios and working out, okay, if this happens, then what are you going to do? If this happens, what are you going to do? So he really began to help these guys who were just kids. You know, they were in their early 20s and they didn't know much about anything, going up in these crazy, dangerous contraptions. There were no manuals. There was little kind of experiential knowledge about, you know, how to fly them, but they kind of would talk about it. And he had to guide them through this thing. And then, you know, and they had to fight. People were shooting at him. So that's where you begin to see this extraordinary, you know, talent that he had to examine, you know, when do you say, okay, I've had enough? When do you turn around? When do you not? When do you push? When you really push hard?
And I suppose he had to weed out the potential flyers who were simply thrill seekers.
Absolutely. And that's always a fine line, too, the thrill seekers, because they would, you know, there's a guy, Frank Luke, who just was just like a comet. He went out and he just had no fear, and he shot down all of these German observation balloons and had some of the biggest kill rates on one day. And Eddie was just getting him transferred to the 94th Squadron. He was in another, the 27th, and he knew that this guy was going to kill himself. And on the day he was to transfer, he got shot down and died.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a constant battle with him, because he became a mentor to these young guys who certainly wanted to go out and fight and wanted to do everything. And yet, how do you kind of take that energy and build it into a real reasonable, you know, a real warrior?
If you want to join our conversation about the daredevil pilot and race car driver and head of Eastern Airlines and owner of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Eddie Rickenbacker, you can join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at KCUR.org, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. And now we've got Russ in Lenexa calling on the phone. Russ, good morning.
I just thought I'd mention a historical note. Seatbelts, the oldest reference I know of was 1898, when a journal described a race in which an electric car had been trouncing the field, but a wheel failed and it rolled off to the side. It didn't actually flip, but it went out of control. But it mentioned the drivers were uninjured because they had been strapped in securely. some people had thought of seatbelts, they just hadn't really caught on yet.
You're absolutely right, Russ. Brings up a very interesting question, is when technology is so new, and there are things, for instance, in World War One, the American headquarters did not issue our flyers parachutes, even though parachutes existed and actually worked, you know, not as effectively as today, but certainly worked. They were concerned with this new technology, the airplane, that that the pilots would jump out of the airplane if they had parachutes at the earliest possible, you know, whenever trouble kind of happened, they would jump out of the plane. This really ticked off Eddie Rickenbacker, who saw a couple of his buddies who would have been saved with parachutes. But so you get this interesting thing when new technology comes on, like cars and seatbelts, where the technology kind of exists, but people haven't really all put it together, you know, that these things can. It's not that they don't want to save people save people's lives, but it's just so new.
Now, John Ross, you've canoed, according to your biography, in the Canadian Arctic, and you've deep-sea dived, and you've dog-sledded in Greenland. So you have a taste for adventure. Do you feel a taste for risk, too?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the reasons I have a little bit of an interesting perspective on Rickenbacker, because yeah. I've been on expeditions all, you know, as a writer and as a journalist and in the past, and just in my own kind of hobby. And I think I have some things to share about small group dynamics. And it was a particularly interesting story, Monroe, about Eddie. You fast forward. F. Scott Fitzgerald said that there are no second acts in among American lives. Well, Eddie had two and three and four of those. And one of them was in World War II. And he went around he was a civilian, but I think he came to Kansas City and gave a real speech, America wake up speech, you know, about really focusing all of their reserves and getting planes in the air. He was sent on a trip to speak with General MacArthur, who was in the South Pacific, to give a secret message from the president. And he was on a B-17 flying out of Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, and his plane went down. He was with seven others, and they were stranded adrift in the middle of the Pacific for 23 days.
Ooh.
And the dynamics of that environment are remarkable. They had no food or water because people hadn't figured yet out about that to put them on lifeboats. And Eddie... Monroe, this getting back to this business about being irascible and unorthodox. He always would come up with unorthodox things. It got very grim on the boats. They were getting sunburned. They had taken off their pants because they thought they were going to be swimming in the water when they went down. They got sunburned and the water went over. They got terrible things. They were hallucinating. And one guy jumped over the side to kill himself. You know, they had just got to the end. This was about 8 or 10 days in. Eddie grabs the guy. They haul him back in. The next morning, the guy is a little chastened, and puts his hand over to Eddie and says, "I'm sorry. Will you forgive me for trying to do that?" And Eddie said, "I'm not shaking your hand until you show me what you've got. You're not a man." And then, of course, he went off to say things I can't repeat on radio. And in the next, 2 weeks, he took control of that group. And whenever anybody got upset, concerned, wondered was going to kill themselves, he started lambasting them and just yelling at them and giving them a hard time. They started hating him. They started hating him worse than they wanted to die. They talked about how they were going to throw him overboard. But this was Eddie coming up with a solution that kept them alive. And years later, these guys, one guy died, but the rest of them, who still were angry at him for being, you know, such a difficult person, all said that they wouldn't have survived without him. It was this irascible nature in him and this coming up with unorthodox, new ways. And that boat trip, you know, when they were finally discovered 23 years days later, was on the front of Life magazine. And in the middle of the war, when it was a tough go in the South Pacific and we were digging the Japanese out of those terrible Pacific atolls, it was Eddie's courage on those boats, and kind of in a, you know, micro climate, that showed America that it had what it took, the courage to move on and to win the war.
It's quite a demonstration of his stature in the American mind, that newspapers and Life magazine and the other things were following this disappearance of the famous flying ace. And it's also an interesting comment that you have in the book that he was on this mission in the first place to MacArthur to try to straighten him out a little. MacArthur himself was an irascible guy, as he proved with Harry Truman years later, but he was sort of defying FDR, too, and that was why Rickenbacker was on his way there. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it was a secret mission. It's only kind of come out, you know, fairly recently what was on that. It was oral orders that he had to go down. FDR knew, you know, MacArthur wanted, was going to run against FDR, and really, you know, there's a lot of, you know, and as we know, MacArthur was outspoken, and they really had nobody else aside from a Rickenbacker who was, you know, he spoke his mind. He was a tough guy. He was a Medal of Honor winner, just like MacArthur, and they thought if anybody could talk some sense into MacArthur, then he could. And after their that terrible boat trip, Eddie, you know, he lost... you know, he was weighed 180, and he ended up weighing 120. He recuperated for a couple of weeks and then continued on his trip down to the South Pacific and hung out, and MacArthur and he became great friends.
It turns out that Eddie was not a giant fan of FDR's domestic programs any more than MacArthur was, a rather conservative fellow.
Absolutely. You know, you got to look in that at that time. What he was later on, he was developing Eastern Airlines, and you know, in the 30s, there was Eastern, American, TWA, and United, and they were really trying to set up continental routes. I mean, they were fighting for hubs in Kansas City and St. Louis, Fort Worth, those types of places, and really build the economies there in their help to in their competition to really bring air flight and passenger flight around the country. And it was a real Wild West sort of time. And FDR kind of, you know, was, Eddie felt was getting in the way, wanted to push a little big government in the way. And Eddie wasn't very happy about that. So most definitely, and spoke his mind about it too.
Now, as we're headed to the break, we've heard the term flying ace a lot of times. There were rules for becoming an ace, weren't there?
Absolutely. And this was, again, kind of being made up as they went. But it became to be that if you were an ace, you had confirmed, in other words, there was independent confirmation that you had shot down five enemy aircraft or balloons, or the enemy balloons.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was tricky, particularly when we were fighting over in Germany, you know, in German territory in France, and flew over, that you were going to have a hard time getting confirmation of that that someone went down. So it was easier if you shot down someone over our lines, but that didn't happen all the time. So there was a lot of backing and forthing and all of that. And Eddie was in a race with this other guy, Doug Campbell, to see who was going to be the first ace. And even though Eddie, in fact, did become the first ace, he didn't get confirmation of it until after Doug Campbell got his fifth. So actually, Doug Campbell goes down in the history books as the first ace. But actually, and Doug Campbell later admitted this, that Eddie was probably the first ace.
Well, we're going to talk some more about Eddie Rickenbacker when we come back, and we'll be back after the break to talk with John Ross, who's an author of a book about this famous guy, who's a speed merchant and flying ace, Eddie Rickenbacker, that is, and we'll talk about the era that took him to its heart. I'm Monroe Dodd, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. With us today is John Ross, author of a brand new book, Enduring Courage, Ace Pilot Eddie Rickenbacker and the Dawn of the Age of Speed. Now, later this month, John will be appearing at the National Archives in Kansas City to discuss the famed pilot's life and times. That's at 6:30 p.m. on May 22nd at the National Archives down near Union Station. John, Eddie Rickenbacker was an ace, but this wasn't an easy task to do. How difficult were those airplanes to fly, and what was it like piloting one?
Boy, I got to tell you, Monroe, it was they called them chicken crates at first because you could put a chicken in the seat of one of these, and there were so many guy wires and spars and all like that the chicken couldn't get out of the airplane. I mean, these things were just downwind from Kitty Hawk, you know, and underpowered at first, And so these guys would go up in these things, and the FAA today says over 10,000 feet, you need to fly with supplemental oxygen. Basically, above 10,000 feet, you're not going to get the oxygen you need, and it's going to start affecting your mental capacities. You're not going to be breathing very well. Well, these guys, of course, were flying up at 17,000, 18,000 feet. Later in the war, got up to 20,000, 21,000 feet. Not only were they dealing with anoxia, not enough oxygen, but they were also dealing with the cold, and it gets cold even in the summer. They would wear these, they call them teddy bear suits. But they would still have to peel their fingers off the joysticks, cool. Because it was so cold up there. And there's this one crazy example of this one kid. I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of diaries and thousands of letters from these guys. And they're all, as I said, in their young 20s, and they were all out. They were drinking the great French wine, and this one kid had opened up in the morning a box of candy that his parents had sent him, ate a couple pounds of it, and then went flying and got up. And it's, these planes, too, moved around a fair amount. They were stable platforms, but you could very easily get feeling nauseous. And he threw up over his cockpit, and it was so cold that his vomit froze over his face and his goggles, so he had to take his goggles off. It was frozen solid. And you imagine this poor guy up there going, he doesn't feel good. There's no radios, right? It was too loud, and radios. They couldn't really take maps up with them, so they got lost all the time. They were freezing. They were feeling sick. The early engines, which were spinning around, exuded castor oil, which was the lubricant. Right. It was the lubricant. Right. And castor oil, I don't know if any of your listeners remember, but does terrible things to your stomach. So about a gallon an hour was spitting back into your face. So one of the reasons they were wearing those scarves, that we think make pilots look so dashing, was to wipe off the castor oil off of their goggles. I mean, if you can imagine that. So these are open cockpits. You're crowded in there. And then the other thing, Monroe, the scary thing about it, those all things that they could kind of deal with. The thing that was very hard that I found references in their writings over and over again was this new thing to warfare, which was that they were sitting on basically pyres. These machines were made of wood covered in fabric with a heavy dose of dope, kind of a shellac over it. They were so flammable that you looked at them and they would catch on fire, right? So sparks from the engine, backfires, all sorts of things. There was a reservoir tank if somebody shot you. And then if you talk, so these guys were looking at, and they had these conversations about, if they were 15,000 feet and they caught fire with the wind up there, their plane, what they were sitting on, could burn up in 2 minutes, and they're still miles above the earth.
Wow.
And so these guys would go, well, what do we do? And they'd have these conversations, So some guys said, no, I'm going to try and ride it out, risk burning to death. A painful way is hard to even imagine.
Mm.
But if you move your plane, it would get the, angle your plane right, the flames would blow out. Other people said, I'm going to take my, fate in my own hands. I'm going to jump. And then a third thing, some took their service revolvers up, Unfortunately that this scenario played out time and again before parachutes came. Imagine the stress of these young guys going up, and that's not even talking about facing these veterans who'd been fighting for 3 years longer than they had been. We were fresh because we were, of course, late to World War One.
You mentioned that the race cars of the time didn't even have geared steering, so that you could be off the track in no time. I presume that these early planes didn't have hydraulics and that kind of stuff, so they must have been physically difficult to steer.
Not too bad. They were light. So, these things kind of, these planes, I think if you see one of them, you'd be surprised at how small. I mean, some of them weighed 700 pounds.
They're sort of like a micro light today, huh?
Yeah. So, it wasn't so much that some of those things were hard. They, they could get in a bad dive. You could really feel some things like that. Certainly, the early cars, as I was saying, the other job, remember we were talking about the mechanician, the guy sitting next to the driver. Well, mm-hmm. one of his also jobs was to pump what looked like a bicycle pump. They didn't have an oil pump, a mechanized oil pump. So, and at these speeds, so this guy would actually manually hit the, be pumping away for all he was worth to keep the oil pressure up. So it's kind of comic.
Oh my gosh. Do you have any questions about Eddie Rickenbacker? You can join our conversation. You can talk about speed, flight, and how the automobile and the airplane changed our country. What do we gain and what do we lose in all of that? Join our conversation at 816-235-2888. Or 816-235-2888, or you can email us at kcur.org, or tweet us at kcurcst. Author John Ross of Enduring Courage, talking about Eddie Rickenbacker. I got to ask a question or two more. If they're way above what's today the recommended level to go without oxygen, and he's diving down to try to shoot down some enemy planes, isn't his mind a little bit loopy even trying to do that?
Absolutely. And there are a couple cases where, people would do some kind of loopy things, and you could kind of, it's hard to know what it was. Was that the adrenaline? What was it about that whole thing? Well, Eddie, the innovator that he was, and make no mistake, these guys who got into these early contraptions were innovating as they were pushing and coming up with new ideas about everything. And one, he noticed that a couple of people he saw one fellow, coming in for a landing. They had come back from, they weren't in any danger. They're coming back to their airfield, their aerodrome, they called it. And they were pretty high. And they got, they would kind of take an angle at the field below at maybe, 5, 6, 8, 10,000 feet, and they would go zooping right down, right?
Yeah.
And this guy passed out, and he, hit the ground and he died. And Eddie, after seeing a couple of those things, he said, something's not right here. And he instituted this plan that he said that everybody in his squadron had to circle the aerodrome twice before he landed. And, you look at that again, it's like the seatbelts or the parachute. Something so simple it started saving huge numbers of lives by just that simple recognition. So what was interesting about Eddie was he had that kind of mind who could look at new technology and look at a situation like that and say, we've got to get around that. We've got to do something better, and we've got to minimize this risk. And, let's try this.
So Eddie Rickenbacker is quite the well-rounded guy. Tell us a little bit about where he came from and how he grew up and any clues in his early upbringing to how he got this way.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's was a kind of a classic immigrant story. His parents came from Swiss Germany. And ended up in Cincinnati on the wrong side of the tracks among the breweries and the tanneries, great, awful-smelling tanneries in Columbus, and dirt poor. One time, Eddie spoke about how he had to go to school with two different shoes. One was a black one, and one was a yellow one. And he got how he got beaten up for that. Unfortunately, his father, this was not, there were a lot of opportunities out there, but it didn't happen to everybody. And his father didn't fit very well into this whole new American thing. It just wasn't working very well. And he got into a very bad situation. And that's an interesting story, Monroe, which I talk about. And other people have talked about it, but not in the way I have. His father was laying sidewalk on a hot day in 1903 with a bunch of guys, and they were taking a break. And this African-American laborer who had been working on some lawns nearby had come over and asked them if they had any extra food. And pretty innocuous, right? Well, this got under Eddie's father's skin, right? Just he just didn't like that. And, he said he was going to give his food to his, if he had any left, to his kids and his wife, and why would he do that? He'd give it to this guy. He chased this guy, and the African-American, basically in defense, he says that Rickenbacker pulled a knife, hit him with a level, a spirit level that they use in construction, and put him in a coma, and Eddie died as Eddie's father died.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a terrible kind of trial about it. And in a time when African Americans, quite frankly, if they killed a white man, whether they were guilty or innocent, that was pretty much it. It was pretty clear that Eddie Rickenbacker's dad had kind of, had set this up, and it was his fault. So the guy got off fairly, easily for those times for a black man, in that sort of situation. Eddie quit school, mm-hmm. and he, even though he had an older brother, who kept in school, he went and he started a job. And he took with him a great sense about being very careful about what anger could do. That was an example. And later he would tell the story of how his father died, and he wasn't quite truthful about that. He said that it was an accident, a construction, a piece of wood on a crane came and hit him in the head, when in fact he really didn't want to talk about that. So he wasn't very honest in his storytelling about his past when he was a big hero.
Hmm. Well, let's go to the caller now, Steve in Lee's Summit. Steve, good morning and welcome.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, good program, good radio. I kind of missed bits and pieces of this, but was there anything in his personal life he may speak about it, love affairs, whether how many times he married, children, and did he have anything to do with carriers?
Great question, Steve. He married divorced woman who he had met before the war. Who was married to a car racing guy, and they got married after the war. And he never seemed to be particularly interested in as a lot of the car racers and the fighter jocks who were just all pretty, pretty big heroes in kind of playing the field or doing that. I didn't see much of that. He had a 50-year marriage to her. And she was the one, when I was talking on that about that raft incident, they called off after about 2 weeks. The Navy called off the search. I mean, they were middle of the war. The Pacific was a big thing. And Adele, his wife, went down and talked to the Secretary of Navy and said, you must continue this search, and berated him. And they continued it for a week. And on the last day of that final week, they found the guys. It's really quite a love story that they had.
Well,
So
she must have raised her voice.
I think, something on the order of you're going to let him die out there, this icon, she believed. And, of course, everybody had started writing obituaries. But they had done that before for Eddie. Was in a very bad car airplane accident in Atlanta 2 years earlier in 1941. On Eastern Airline flight down to Atlanta, and they crashed in the woods outside of Atlanta in the mountains. And it was so gruesome that rescuers came and they left him for dead because he was so gruesomely injured, and he survived it. It's hard to know how he survived that.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Let's go now to Mike in Kansas City, Kansas, on the telephone. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead with your question.
Yes. Just wondering, to the author, motorcycling and aviation kind of grew up side by side, reference to the Wright Brothers bicycle shop, and then the famous Glenn Curtis, motorcyclist and in turn aviator. I'm just wondering if Mr. Rickenbacker ever in his life had taken up a motorcycling or dabbled in that a little bit, because, like I said, those were two common early aviation and motorcycle were pretty well parallel to each other at the time. Thanks.
Absolutely, Mike. I don't have any evidence that he raced motorcycles, but he there's some really wonderful pictures of him in World War One. The squadron had a Harley Davidson with a sidecar, and boy, he seemed to be on that more often than he was not. And so he and I have other anecdotal information about him riding motorcycles just kind of for the fun, but never racing it. And that's a good question that you raise. I haven't thought about why he wasn't interested in that. I don't think the purses were as big. I don't think that's where he felt the sport was of racing was going. But he loved his bikes.
John Ross, among the characteristics of Eddie Rickenbacker, you mentioned that he was in several crashes and in several dire straits, several times. Yet that did not seem to affect his confidence. Is that not right?
Yeah, it's a curious thing. He claimed that he had died, come close to death, more than anybody on Earth had. And, you know, I mean, it's a pretty big claim. But, you know, you start reading my book and you realize, wow, I mean, it might be true. From failed tonsillectomies to almost getting hit by coal trucks as a kid. And then this 1941 Eastern Airline crash that we just were referencing. I mean, he had... he went down, and he was right in the middle of the plane, and they were flying. He was doing his work. He was in a honeymoon suite, you know, because he was the boss. And he was chatting with this the steward, and he looked out the window, and he saw one of the plane, one of the looked outside and saw that the trees on this mountain were very close, and the pilot had screwed up the altitude in coming in, and one. Of his wing, the wings went down, and he knew, and then Eddie knew immediately that they were going to be, you know, go down because the plane, the pilot counteracted and put his left one down, and it threw the plane up, and Eddie threw himself back, and the middle, right where he was, the middle of the plane, you know how balloons twist, you know, when, you know, you can twist a balloon like that, it twisted and broke the plane in half, and he had just made it. And he was stuck in this bulwark, right, and right on top of the body of his dead steward, who wasn't so lucky. And the plane came down, and he was just beaten up. He'd broken his leg, broken his ribs. And so they're out there, and it's at night, it's raining, it's out in the middle of nowhere on this mountain. But some people in the back were thrown out, and they talk about lighting, you know, a fire. And he can hardly speak. Because he's so injured. But he goes, no, don't. He's covered in petrol, right? And if they had lit a fire, it would have just exploded. It lit up, right? So he's trying to get out. He's trying to move out. He doesn't realize that there's a piece of aluminum, sharp piece of aluminum right above his eye. And he finally gets out. He breaks a rib doing it. And this thing pops his eye out so that it's hanging on his cheek. Right, and then he's praying just to pass out at this point because it's so painful. Finally in the morning, the rescuers find this plane, and they look at him, and a couple people go over and are sick because he just looks like he's a Frankenstein. They take him in, they take him down to this hospital, and it's just a touch and go thing. And he describes after a while, Monroe. He says, you know, I got so close to death a couple times, I knew what it was like. It was this lovely thing on the other side that if I just let go, everything would be fine. It was like almost like there was music or something beautiful there if I just let go. But then something would kick into this guy. Something would kick into this irascible, crusty guy and say no. And he would pull himself back from it, and he would find a way to live. He just would find a way to live. And when he was in that terrible situation on the rafts, I mean, just awful, he gave those guys on the raft a master's course in survival because he had been there. And these other guys experienced all like that stuff, had never been through that. And he taught them how to survive when you think there's no, you just can't go on. And it's just an incredible story. And that's why I named it Enduring Courage. I mean, he learned. This is not the current courage of white hot courage where you suddenly get, well, I'm going to do this. This is a lifetime of really understanding what it takes to stand up and to live and to fight through the adversities that we face.
Astounding human being. Let's go now to Mike and Shawnee. Good morning, Mike, and welcome.
Hey, good morning. What a great yarn. I can't wait to read your book. You know, it's easy to find when I've been kind of listening this morning. It's easy to find heroes, aviation heroes from World War II. I mean, Richard Bong and Ensign George Gay and Pappy Boyington. I mean, there are many of them. And it's easy to find race car heroes from the last 50, 60 years. It's hard. I can't think of another guy like Rickenbacker that combined two or three different things into a huge career, and I guess my question is it even possible for those kind of men and women to even exist anymore, or have we gone so far away from that era and the ease of putting your life on the line that it'll just never happen again?
Mike, thank you. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that new technologies will present, you know, other people. You know, you look at Bill Gates, that's not risking your life, but when the computer came on and was early, you got kind of these amateurs really just, you know, developing new things. I think when new technology comes along, but yes, you're right. I mean, the training we put our astronauts through now is not something that Eddie, who never had a college degree, could even have thought about. I mean, he didn't finish seventh grade. Couldn't have thought about. So war, new technology, gave him an environment where, and at the perfect time, he could really develop that, these leadership things. One thing is interesting, I think what startled me a little bit in the book was reading about, you know, yes, you have aces and terrific warriors, examples of bravery in the infantry and small group commando leaders and such things like that. Rarely do they step, as Eddie did, from that into squadron command, command leadership, and really make a real difference in that. And he took the 94th, as you were called, the 94th Squadron, which had been down in the dumps. They were facing huge losses against veteran German opponents, and they were really down in the dumps. They just switched airplanes to SPAD from the Newport. They were getting used to that. Eddie came in and turn them around in only a matter of weeks, turn them around with a whole bunch of leadership ways, which is an interesting story in of itself, how he did that. So another thing I find interesting about Eddie is that he's unusual in the sense that, you know, he was a great fighter ace, perhaps not the best, but he was a person who made a transition to leadership and could understand that. And that's, but so you get a real sense of that this time was when, and these pivotal moments in American history, when real people step up for their talent is kind of recognized and appropriate, but also, you know, his persistence. You know, they didn't let World War I, they only let college graduates fly. In the war. So what was a seventh grade dropout with a correspondence course doing in there? Well, that's an incredible story. You got to read my book.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Let's go now to Lee in Liberty. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning. How's everybody doing? You all sound great.
Good. You do too.
Thank you.
All right. I wanted to ask a question of the author or ask him, did he know about any entrepreneurial skills that Eddie might have had? When my husband lived in the Valley in Southern California as a child back in the 60s, there was a model model plane shop that Eddie owned where my husband used to buy his model airplanes.
No kidding.
It was called,
that's great.
Yeah, it was called Eddie Rickenbacker's.
That's incredible.
I didn't know if he knew of that. Isn't that incredible? I thought it was a cool story to relate to you guys.
Okay.
That's one great thing about this this book is I've been getting people, and I hope more people, too, will be calling up and telling me stories about that. It's quite interesting. His entrepreneurial skills were pretty remarkable with Eastern Airlines. He was the first person to introduce the whole shuttle going from New York to, 20-plus flights from New York to Washington frequently. Nobody kind of thought about that. He introduced the 40-hour work week for mechanics, and he was always thinking and always, I mean, I think that's probably what part of his irascibility. He was always moving, always moving, always moving, always thinking, always searching for the best new thing, what could make things better, you know, and all that. I think that was the root, and a pretty sharp guy on top of it for a lot of his innovations in the entrepreneurial world that came out of his squadron command that came to help really form our airline system in this country. Very critical to that.
Lee, thanks for your call. We're getting close to the end here, John. I in looking around for references to Eddie Rickenbacker in Kansas City, I found a quote that a reporter got from his speech down at Convention Hall in 1919 when he was touring the country. The question about how he felt in battle, and the quote says he said, "I know I was utterly transported from an ordinary breathing human being into a machine. I felt no exaltation whatsoever." And that sort of sounds like the guy you've been describing.
Absolutely. And what he brought, and this really gets down quintessentially to really the model that he set up that a lot of our explorers and businessmen and entrepreneurs, have it, is this kind of Midwestern practicality. And they're not going to get thrown by getting caught up too much in the rush of the moment, because that could make you make bad decisions. It can get you in trouble. So he pioneered, and not the only guy, but with some others, this real sense of leadership. I mean, you see it with George Washington, and you see it with Lincoln and U.S. Grant and such things. But he pioneered it in the modern age, so there was a real even-tempered thing. He couldn't let himself get too engaged in the excitement of it, because that was going to affect his performance. And he became a past master at that. And, as we spoke about earlier, looking at risk, how far he could push things. He always knew exactly where, how far he was pushing it. It was really risky, but he knew what the risks were as best he could.
That's all the time we have for today's show about the 20th century daredevil and flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker and how he reflected his times. Our guest has been John Ross, author of Enduring Courage, Ace Pilot Eddie Rickenbacker and the Dawn of the Age of Speed, which I will give you the testimony is a page-turner. John will speak about his book May 22nd at 6:30 p.m. at the National Archives in Kansas City, downtown near Union Station. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Monroe, thanks for having me. It was great fun.
You can listen to this program again or subscribe to our podcast or listen to any of our previous programs at kcur.org/Central Standard. Join us again Monday at 10 as we explore Kansas Pride. Up to date, it's just a minute away. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our senior editor is Sylvia Maria Gross, and our announcer is Linda Scher. I'm Munro Dodd. This is KCUR, and enjoy your weekend.